Yeah. Let's call this meeting to order. We have a pretty full agenda today, and as noted, you have the schedule for the committee. How are you doing this morning? But anyway, you have Bill, Representative Wilkins.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move to reconsider House File 3538.
This is in a Trumbull bill that probably shouldn't have gone to this committee, but we have to lay it over because of the deadline date, to be courteous to her. Is that correct?
That's one.
For consideration of an omnibus bill. All in favor of reconsidering this bill, say aye.
Aye.
Both same sign. Motion carries. Now we want to lay this bill over. What's the file number?
3538.
3538 for possible consideration of an omnibus bill. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Both same sign. Thank you. We got that done. And first, Representative Mahoney.
Do we have a quorum?
Yes, we do.
I'd like to move the minutes.
Very well. Representative Mahoney would like to move the minutes of March 30th. All in favor of that motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Both same sign. Thank you very much.
I supported your motion.
Appreciate that. Listen, I'm not telling my account. First, we have the formality of looking at the governor's supplementary budget bill for our division. And as custom, traditional lay it over and use that somewhat of a framework for what we have to do. And it's House File 4062, and I'll move that bill. And basically, we have seven other bills, so we don't have a lot of time to go through this bill. However, we will be working with it rather extensively in the next few days. So I would appreciate just having the thing laid over for possible inclusion. We do have a target, by the way. I don't want anybody to get too carried away, but we don't have to cut. So with that, I will move House File 4062 for possible. Just lay it over, okay? Next, we will go into real people's bills. Representative Hamilton, see you? Just don't see him. How about Representative Mahoney?
Here, I'll give you my cell phone.
Welcome to your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to move House File 3891 for possible inclusion.
Very well.
Members, Mr. Chair, this is a bill that appropriates $1 million each year in 06 and 07 for the University Enterprise Laboratories. This is one of the biozones here in the metro area. This is located in one of the biozones in the metro area here in the St. Paul side of 280. This is our laboratory. I can't remember off the top of my head exactly how many square feet, but I'm sure one of my testifiers will tell us that. One of the things that I want to bring to the attention of the committee is that in most of our states around here, there is a significant investment by the state in their bio incubators. Minnesota has not done that at this particular time, and this is a bill that tries to rectify that. This is a important bill for this file zone, an incubator to continue on. And with that, I'd like to present my testifiers and let them take it from here because they're much more knowledgeable about it than I. So with that, Mr. Olson.
Welcome to our committee again, Mr. Olson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Mahoney. My name is Randy Olson. I am the general manager of the University Enterprise Laboratories Incorporated. I believe each of you have an informational packet regarding the UEL, and I just wanted to highlight some points that Representative Mahoney referenced earlier. The UEL opened in September of 2005 as a premier bioscience incubator, and the actual size of the UEL is about 126,000 square feet. We have to date 16 bioscience tenants, and we also have four supporting organizations, including the University of Minnesota's Office of Business Development. And the overall strategic goal of the UEL is to grow bioscience companies and obviously to contribute to the growth of the bioscience industry in Minnesota. And then the UEL will be the first of what we hope will be several incubators located in the Twin Cities Bioscience Research Center corridor. And there is also some information on that corridor plan in your informational packets. As Representative Mahoney referenced, the state of Minnesota is somewhat unique in its lack of support of a biosciences incubator or research park. And again, on the right-hand side of your informational packet is a memo. The memo contains information on best practices of other states. The board of directors of the UEL embarked on a very ambitious project last year to evaluate what other states' support, financial support, has been over the years for their incubators and research parks. And so they captured information, for example, about Georgia Tech, Iowa State University, North Dakota State University, the University of North Dakota, the South Dakota Technology Business Center, and the University of Wisconsin. And in all situations, the state either provided upfront funding or have contributed on an ongoing basis annual funding to support their incubators and research parks. There's also a website that's maintained by Battelle that has a national profile of business incubators and research parks. And again, overwhelmingly, these parks and incubators are supported in part through state appropriations. I might add that the UEL to date has had no funding from the state of Minnesota. In fact, we have raised over $9 million in corporate sponsors from the likes of 3M, St. Jude Medical, Guidant Corporation, Boston Scientific, Allina, and also the city of St. Paul has been, and through its Port Authority, has been a strategic partner in the financing of the UEL. I have this morning an individual by the name of David Masters. David has been a tenant of the UEL since its opening, but he also has a long history of being involved with the bioscience industry here in Minnesota, and he is the president of a company called Geldel Technologies.
Welcome to our committee. Give me a name for the record. So 100 years from now, we know you're here.
Sure. My name is Dr. David Masters, and I am the president and scientist inventor of Geldel Technologies, which is a company where we are taking forward technology that simulates the body's own tissue. A little bit about me. I received my PhD in neurobiology from Rutgers University. I became an instructor at Harvard Medical School some years ago, and then moved on to become an associate consultant at the Mayo Clinic. And in the year of 2000, decided that I needed to leave the Mayo Clinic, and take this technology forward. A little history about that. You know, during the 90s, there was this controversy over breast implants, making it very difficult for anyone to develop new implant technology, and also making it difficult to take forward that kind of program at the Mayo Clinic and other places where liability was a big issue. So in 2000, I looked around to see where I could take this company, and there was something starting here in Minnesota in a bioscience way to create these incubators for companies like my own, and decided to try that. We have gone forward over the past 6 years to a point now. We are taking our first product to clinical trials in June, and this first product is a wrinkle treatment using this tissue filler that turns basically into our own skin over time, so that when you put it into the wrinkle, it activates a natural healing process that then creates more skin to take care of that wrinkle. We're also taking forward with this technology a blood vessel graft, which we have been working in clinical trials, towards clinical trials at the VA Medical Center, and hoping that in the next 2 years we take that forward to clinical trials. Now, the UEL is something that is very important to companies like my own to support this kind of program in university and the university setting, where academics can take forward a technology like this, which has all these wonderful things that can be created. Without support at the very early stages, it's very difficult to get a technology like this to go forward. Other states, East Coast, West Coast, are doing this kind of financial development and adding resources to help this kind of thing go forward. So, excuse me. Support from the community and state will prove to be needed for Geldo and other bioscience companies to compete with other states that are supporting their incubators. Employees will choose to go to states with companies that have the best chance for succeeding, or that a critical mass to companies to provide additional employment opportunities. Since jobs in these companies provide premium wages for employees, Minnesota should do everything it can to help maintain and grow bioscience companies and these employment positions. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Horn.
Thank you, Mr. Master. I have an old friend that wanted to say a few things on this particular bill, and an old colleague. Not an old colleague.
Thank you a lot. And a nice welcome. Howdy do to you, too.
That is
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning. Give your name
and members. I'm Lynn Ostrom, and I serve on the BioBusiness Alliance Board of Directors. Some of you will recall that this was a passion of mine when I had the privilege to serve in the Minnesota House. And I'm really excited to tell you that the BioBusiness Alliance Board is an outgrowth of the original Bioscience Council that the governor had appointed a couple of years ago. We're really excited about the public and private partnership that has evolved. And what we're working on right now is a statewide assessment of all of our bio assets in the state. And what I can tell you is that the Board of Directors is going to be releasing that assessment soon. And when we look at projects, the likes of which you're hearing about today, UEL or the Life Science Corridor, we're really excited about the potential that Minnesota is likely to realize as years go by, and we're excited to work with UEL and now Randy and others to have them be a solid part of the bio plan for our state of Minnesota. We're really excited about the fact that in this particular case, the students at the university, just due to the proximity of where UEL is, that they'll have the opportunity to really live their studies in this environment. We would really encourage you strongly to support this request that Representative Mahoney has brought before you. And even though I can't lobby on behalf of the BioBusiness Alliance, I would like to let you know that we will be coming to share more information with you about that assessment as well. So thanks for the opportunity.
Very well. I have a question for Dr. Master.
Yes.
Now, with 17 clients from UEL being there, do you share and partner with each other in any way?
Absolutely. There's a lot of sharing that goes on. And the biggest problem with that kind of sharing, though, is that we're all startup companies, and financing any kind of new ideas is difficult. So we constantly try and figure out how we can help each other.
I would think that would be a very good environment for stuff like that.
Absolutely.
Representative Mahoney.
Well, and Mr. Chair, this is a final comment. This is an important economic development for the metro region, and hopefully as we build here, we can push as much of this out to the rural areas and the use of this technology in the rural areas. And as a final, an absolute final comment, Dr. Masters spoke to the East and the West Coast. It would be good for our state to figure out ways to keep these companies here. You know, our pension fund has, and I want to get this on the record, has on occasion invested in venture capital firms that from the East and West Coast that raid these particular companies and then take them out to the East and the West Coast. And hopefully next year, in a policy year, we can speak to that a little bit more. But I won't go down that road because we'll just take the committee too long. So with that, I'd like to renew my motion that this be included for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you very much. We'll do that. And thank you for your testimony. It's very exciting. Thanks for bringing the bill here.
Thanks very much.
Yeah. Representative Lanning. Welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Appreciate your hearing House File 3857. And we do have an amendment that just clarifies the intent of this simple language. So I would ask that you consider the amendment in moving the bill.
Very well. I will move House File 3857 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Okay. And the amendment is
A1.
You want to describe? I keep passing it out. No wonder I couldn't find it. Amendment?
I can explain the amendment. I think it simply clarifies what we're referring to on line 9. It says currently the employer must allow employee access to an employer-owned computer to review and print earnings statements. And the clarification is deleting the first two words on line 9, the employer, and instead inserting an employer who chooses to provide an earnings statement by electronic means. So it's just a clarification.
Okay, does everyone understand the amendment? Okay, I will move Amendment A1 for inclusion. All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion carries. It goes the way you want it, I hope.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Current law says that employers shall give each employee an earnings statement in writing. And it doesn't refer at all to or by electronic means. And what this bill simply does is to allow employers to use electronic means to provide earnings statements to employees. And then it gives some protection to employees that the employer must provide access to employer computers in order for employees to access and print out that information. So that's very simply what the bill is. More and more states are doing this, and I understand that also federal government is moving in this direction, and so I think it's time for Minnesota to insert this language into our law regarding earnings statements. Mr. Chairman and members, I have with me today Cindy Fagerly, who is with Region 1 Information Management Systems, and she has over 20 years of experience in doing payroll for work, and she is the one who originally brought this bill idea to me, and so I'd like to call on her. Cindy is also a member of the Moorhead School Board, and so she has viewed the need for this from a local elected official perspective as well.
Welcome to the committee. Give your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Cindy Fagerly.
You want to bring the microphone over? That'll help.
There we go. Okay. Can you hear me now? Good morning. My name is Cindy Fagerly, and I am a payroll processor for Region 1 Information Management Services in Moorhead. Region 1 is one of five regions in the state that provides computer services and software support for payroll, finance, and student business functions for about two-thirds of the school districts in the state of Minnesota. And as Representative Lanning said, I am also a member of the Moorhead School Board. I will speak to speak from my experience with regards to school districts, because that's what I have, that experience. But I do understand that this bill or this amendment to the statute would affect all employers in the state of Minnesota. I do believe that the benefits of the bill or the amendment is universal to private and public sector entities. To give you some background, in 2004, the legislature authorized mandatory direct deposit pay of employees of municipalities. With that, and with the okay from the Department of Labor, software companies or applications were enhanced to provide for paperless payrolls or electronic earnings statements. Regional software calls that employee self-service, or ESS. ESS allows for an employee to log into a password-protected, safe and secure website to view their earnings statements, year-to-date information, historical information, other personal information at their convenience, day or night. It wasn't long and school districts recognized the benefits of going paperless. For instance, the monetary gains that they would see without having to order special forms, do envelopes, process payroll itself, the paper itself, folding and stuffing machines that are used to do multiple entries, not to mention the bank statement processing, stop payments on lost checks, and so forth. So they found that it's going to be more efficient and cost effective. They began implementing it, and shortly after that, they received an opinion from the Attorney General's office stating that they must continue to give each employee an earnings statement in writing. Well, at that time, the school districts didn't want to violate state law, so they stopped processing paperless payrolls, and I, for the first time ever, wrote my local legislator. I believe in amending Statute 181 completes the 2004 legislation regarding mandatory direct deposit. It fits the two together that if a person receives direct deposit, they shouldn't have to also receive something in writing stating that when they can go online and look at the information. Most importantly, it offers a simplified method for employers to distribute earnings statements. The proposal also recognizes, Representative Lanning stated, that not all employees may have access to computers. And to safeguard that, language was added that if they don't, the employer offers electronic earnings statements, that the employee would have access to employer-owned computers during the workday at their convenience to print and review the earnings statements. My research has found that at least 14 states and various institutions within those states, including the federal government, the Department of Defense, and the Department of Energy, for instance, are issuing electronic earnings statements. So this isn't something new that has just started. It's been going on for some years now. Providing the electronic earnings statements is a safe and secure proven method of getting information to employees. And in fact, going paperless is now being promoted nowadays as being more secure way of doing business than paper because of the identity theft issues. I have no doubt that the employees would embrace this technology and find the convenience very nice for them to be able to log in anytime, day or night, to get this information. In fact, employees are able to get this information right now through our software and are doing so, but the statute makes us still hand out paper documents to them. Clarifying the statute would offer an option to employers without violating state law. I believe the paperless payrolls are a way of the future. Like I said, it's been done for many years already in some institutions, and it would be nice to update our statute to accommodate that same modification and modernization. I hope I've painted a clear picture of the advantages. It's going to be more efficient and cost-effective for employers, no doubt. Mm-hmm. And I hope the committee supports the amendment. And whether we're in private business or in the public sector, we're all trying to do more with less. And I think this is one good example. It's a step towards coming into the 21st century and being more cost-effective and efficient in our services and resources. So thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Intriguing idea. I don't know about some of the detail, but it does strike me, though, that there ought to be a fiscal note with this, that it would seem like this could have some savings for Dewar and other places that we fund. Was any kind of fiscal note sought from this?
Mr. Soderbergh.
Mr. Chairman, no. If the bill, if you want to progress the bill, I think the language is may do this, either in writing or, and so it's not. Usually a fiscal note is when there's a shall or required activity. It could very well, I could request a fiscal note because when I first read it, I thought it was just permissive. And the answer would be, it may be if we do it. But I could surely write one out. Sure, I could request one.
Well, Representative Bailey.
Well, just there are some shalls in there, but regardless of that, it would seem to me that as a very technologically astute state, we'd jump right on this opportunity.
Representative Sturridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Ryan, I appreciate you bringing this bill forward. This does make sense, but there are some individuals who, as you put in here, still like to have a piece of paper in their hand at some point for their own files or to have some sort of record of what's going on. So I like that the language that you've put in here and then amended, but I think we need to take it just in one more step just to make sure this works, at least for me. I would propose an oral amendment, Mr. Chair. On line 9, strike the word allow and insert the word provide. And then Ms. Long can help me out. I want to do something else as well. What I don't want to happen is for an employee to have to maybe come in when they're not working to access this or anything like that. So I just want to tighten this up, and I believe Ms. Long has a good place to put the rest of my amendment.
Ms. Long.
Mr. Chair, Representative Sertich, on line 9, after computer, insert during an employee's regular working hours.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
I just think it's a good idea that this it be available for them to print out, and I think if we're going to, on line 7, say provide, I think to stay consistent, provide is better than allow because it's more inviting to make sure that employees have access to this. And then during regular business hours, I'd hate to say that, sure, you can come in and print at 9 o'clock on a Wednesday night, you know, and that just puts in a new barrier. So I think this helps alleviate some potential concerns that I don't think would be out there, but just to make sure to have this strong language.
Representative Lanning, what do you think of the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sertich, thank you. I think you've improved the language here. We certainly support it.
Okay. Does everybody understand the amendment? All in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign. Motion carries.
Mr. Chairman, we have one other person to testify.
I notice that.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Kirk Schneidlin, representing the Minnesota School Boards Association, and Cindy's done a wonderful job sharing the advantage of this. And she's gone as far as getting MSBA support on this by submitting this to our delegate assembly and having our school board members from across the state vote on this and certainly support this piece. And it's something that as an employer would certainly, school boards as an employer would certainly support a safe and secure change that would make business practices far more efficient. So we appreciate your support.
Representative Mahoney.
Representative Lane, is this for all employers or is it just school boards?
Representative
Ryan. Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, it's for everyone, all employers.
Representative Mahoney.
Can an employee still request a paper receipt or, you know, what do you call this, earning statement? I mean, and here's my concern is, you know, when I'm not at the legislature, I work out and as a construction worker. It would be very simple for a contractor to just give me a check at the on payday for, you know, whatever dollars I've earned that particular week, and say you'll have to go look online to get your stuff. And with the amendment, that certainly tightens it up, but I just know there's people out there that still think pensions are kind of a newfangled idea, and they want to see it in paper. They're not even happy that they're getting paid in with a check. They still want cash, which I always find amusing to talk to some of these people. So if someone says, you know, that's fine, but I still want my earnings statement in paper. Your bill doesn't allow that. Something to think about. I'm not going to try and fix the bill right here, but you might want to, before it gets to the floor, think about a way to say that, you know, put that in for an employee that they still can request that without penalty. Just a suggestion.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I would interpret the language as not saying it has to be all one way or the other, and I think any employer who has employees that still insist on it in writing, I don't think this bill changes that the right of that employee to still ask for that. But I understand your point, and it could be open for interpretation. My interpretation would be that it's not an all or either or, that being all or none.
My concern is that if somebody says, you know, I really want a paper trail, they'll say, well, if you don't like it, go somewhere else. And it's pretty common in a number of particular industries, and particularly the gray collar type industries, if you don't like it, they say go. And if that's the case, then you're kind of forced into it. There's a variety of things that I could explain here, but I'm just suggesting that might be something to take a look at and add your language to it by the time it gets to the floor or on the floor as an author's amendment.
Okay.
Okay. Representative Kuzelka, at that point?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And, Representative Mahoney, my concern is that the way it's worded now, it could be a cost savings to the business. And if we require them dual systems, it could actually cost them more. I think Representative Sertich's amendment takes care of what you're talking about. They can actually get a printed one every time if they want. They can come in and actually print it on the employer's paper. You know, so I'm concerned that we actually, if we do what you're talking about, make this worse than it is right now.
Representative Nelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I've got the same concerns that Representative Mahoney has, and I guess I'm taking a step farther. Is in the job site, even people that work where there's computer access maybe where they have, but they never work on it. They don't have personally access to a computer. You know, to say that they're going to give them access, they're going to have some place where they can access it. But if you're working for a construction company and there isn't possibly a computer on the job site, and maybe the only place that the employee can access a company computer is is in their regional office that could be miles away or even cities away, saying they must give them access when there isn't a place to do it, it's like you said, if they ask for it in paper, they're... I can see and I've actually had some experience with this in a past employer where they switched to electronic checks, and people that wanted it were basically told, like Representative Mahoney said, if you don't like it, leave. So, I mean, I guess that's a concern I have that we need to watch out for, because not all, even public employers, are like school districts where you have access to computers. Everybody has access to computers. There are many municipalities and many private employers where only a handful of the employees have access or know how to use the computer, and there's still a lot of neophytes out there that don't even know how to turn it on, and I've worked with many of those, and they don't even have one in their home, so to say that they have electronically, that's the same as not giving it to them. Another concern I have is that would this override, I mean, there are some people have contracts where they have to provide a written paycheck every week, and even if it's electronically deposited, the contract says they have to do that. I want to make sure this isn't going to override existing contracts that are out there.
Yes, so I think our testifier's got some answers to that question.
Maybe I can offer some clarification, hopefully. With what regard to your talking about with your concerns, only municipalities can mandate direct deposit. Therefore, a construction company or a private business or some other private employer would still be offering paper checks, and therefore this would be a moot point because the employee would be handed a paper check because they have to take it to the bank to cash it. Does that help any?
Representative Nelson.
In one of my previous jobs, I worked as a carpenter for a municipality, had no access to computers, had no way to access them. There's a whole range of people that work for municipalities that aren't school teachers that don't use computers every day, and so I have no access to them. And to say that you have to give them access, they're going to have some place where they can log in. Right now, they may not even know how to do that. And so I'm saying that's even in the municipalities where this is happening, and like I said, the municipality I worked with, that when they went to paper transfer and then they mandatorily went to electronic transfer, there were some people that didn't have bank accounts so that they could transfer the money too. So there are still some people out there. We're not all up in the 21st century. I mean, that's an assumption we make sometimes, that everybody knows how to run a computer. There are a lot of people out there working for, even for municipalities, that don't have a clue on how you even turn the computer on, let alone how you get on the internet, let alone how you get into a computer database that you with a password to access that computer. They don't have a clue, and it'd be like if I was sitting here talking German to you while everyone else is speaking English. There are some people out there that are still that far behind.
Representative Mahoney.
Mr. Chair and members and Representative Lanning, I don't want to slow your bill down, and we've got a full agenda. If you're willing to work with me over the next couple of days, there's a fairly simple solution. Just somewhere in the bill we say that upon request, an employer must provide I don't care how they do it, whether they print it out and they send it in the mail, you know, a day later. That's not the issue here. It's just there's got to be some way that somebody can get a paper trail, and that's all we're saying.
Yeah.
And I'm more than willing to work with you, and I think your idea is a fine idea, but we just have to provide for those, as my colleague says, those people who are not technologically advanced enough to kind of do this. So I'm more willing to work with you on that.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Mahoney, I'm certainly willing to do that. Just one further thought here. The language, as we have now amended it with Representative Sertich's wording, I remind you, it says the employer must provide employee access to a computer-owned computer, employer-owned computer during the workday. If that's not feasible, then they can't do it electronically. I mean, I think the language that we have here right now takes care of much of this concern.
Representative Bravo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanning, do we know when the Attorney General's opinion was issued?
I believe it was the fall of 2004.
Fall of 2004? Because some of us may or may not have been receiving our pay stubs electronically for 2.5 to 3 years, so that's kind of interesting. So, thanks. It's a good bill, by the way. You did a good job suggesting it to him.
Representative Surtich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to the intent of the language that I included, the one potential interpretation of this is, as maybe Representative Nelson was saying, to provide during business, during their work hours, an employer could say, yeah, you can use the computer back at the regional office, but you have to take time off. And I just want to, for the record, say that's not the intent of what I proposed there, just to get that on the record.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Seeing none, I will renew my motion to have House File 3857. There it is. Be laid open for possible inclusion on omnibus bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
Next, we have Representative Hamilton. Representative Wilkins moves House File 3784 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Representative Wilkins, for moving the bill. The legislature last year provided an increase to the reimbursement rate paid through the Department of Economic Employment and Economic Development to extended employment provider organizations, passing additional appropriations beyond the base funding. This bill, House File 3784, acknowledges that the legislature action last year states the increase of $1 million for this biennium as a one-time funding. Now, Mr. Chair and committee members, it would truly be problematic for the extended employment providers if this remains a one-time appropriation rather than making it a part of the base funding administered by DEED. Yes, we have everybody here. With me this morning, starting off, Barbara Arnold. She's with Accessibility Incorporated, an extended employment provider. Past president, as I am fully informed, of MACRA, of the Minnesota Community Rehabilitation Organization. MACRA's membership is comprised of organizations providing extended employment services for persons with disabilities, and she'll further explain the importance of the funding and why it's so critical that the funding not slip back to the base prior to the increase. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer up some additional testimony.
Could you give your name for the record, please?
My name is Barbara Arnold, and I'd like to wish you all a great good morning and a sunny day, Mr. Chair and committee members. And thank you for the opportunity to speak with you again regarding the extended employment or EE services throughout our state. The extended employment program provides jobs and jobs training for approximately 6,900 individuals a year with severe disabilities. The support is given to people who haven't had success in getting a job or retaining a job. And usually it's for individuals that are not eligible for other employment programs, people that fall through the cracks in our system. The way it works is that the extended employment providers and businesses have a good working relationship in their community. Businesses contract directly with extended employment providers for work done. The work is performed at their business site or at our site, depending if they need some outsourcing. But the majority of our primary objective and the majority of our people are working in the businesses, and businesses hire the individuals through the program. It's important to note that that majority of the people are working in the business community. The funds that come from the state are very important to the EE provider's ability to keep programs running smoothly. The unemployment rate for people with disabilities in Minnesota is 52%, and for people with severe mental illness, it's 70%, and we've even seen numbers in some communities where it's 85%. The way EE works in terms of state funding is that the Department of Employment and Economic Development provides grants to the EE providers on a pay-for-performance basis. Organizations receive state funds only when they produce results, that is, when the participants are working. The EE provider is reimbursed on an hourly basis, and not hourly pay for the individual. The pay is coming from the business community. It's just based on performance. Now, on the EE-SMI program, that operates a little differently than the regular EE program. The services are paid on an hourly or daily fee for services set up by the Division of Rehabilitation Services. This system allows for the potential for more in-depth services on the front end of the job, such as the job development and job placement, as well as individualized participant support and some level of crisis intervention. These two EE programs served over 6,900 participants last year, and I guarantee you we all have waiting lists of people that want to come into this program, every provider out there. The participants earned $27,861,000 in wages. With wages earned, people pay toward their food and housing, even if they are in supported housing. They pay taxes, as well as have some discretionary dollars to spend. They're able to move toward greater self-sufficiency. And it's important to note that before entering the EE services, these people did not earn any wages, zero. So the programs work, and they do help people to stay employed. The bill today passed would mean that the increased dollars for EE Basic and EE SMI would be made part of the base funding for these programs, and hopefully a successful program like this will continue to grow in future years. With me today is Lori Sterner from Goodwill Industries, and Lori is a placement manager who manages the specialists that are doing job development and placement in the community. And I'd like to turn over to her. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'd just like to remind everybody we have four bills to go after this one in 15 minutes.
Thank you. Representative Gunther and members of the committee, thanks for the opportunity to testify. I am Lori Sterner with Goodwill Easter Seals. Extended employment is a process that is multifold, and it requires expertise and knowledge of how to support individuals with the most severe disabilities throughout their job search, upon placement, and ultimately throughout their employment. The process requires much time and effort to make the right job match, which ultimately ensures job retention. The process is ongoing, and it requires nurturing to sustain our relationships with potential and established employers. We network with similar agencies like ourselves, and we share job leads and ideas. We also network with employers through civic organizations like the Rotary, Chamber of Commerce, and continually market to new business partners in an effort to grow and diversify opportunities. It involves getting to know the participant. Providers such as ourselves use a variety of means to get to know the participants. There are formal processes, including evaluation and testing, but most importantly, it involves an informal process of getting to know the individual through observation and conversation. Participants are placed according to their expressed needs, preferences, abilities, and desires. It continues by using a work-first model, which includes placing and training the individual on the job. Working with the individual in the actual work environment is one of the best sources of information as to how to support the individual because it incorporates the unique nuances of the specific work setting. It moves on to job development and placement, and in order to secure appropriate employment with the best chance for job retention, the provider must use a variety of methods. For some individuals, the jobs they are best suited for already exist and traditional methods are employed. For many others with a more severe disability, the position might actually need to be created or carved. This is a process whereby the provider works with an employer to identify specific tasks needing to be performed and matches those tasks to the specific abilities of the individual with the disability. job carving results in the creation of a position which didn't previously exist, but one which allows the individual to use their talents in a meaningful way while meeting the employer's needs. This is a win-win situation. Moving on to the provision of proper supports, we must be trained to identify the appropriate supports each individual needs. It can include securing accommodations such as equipment, technology, a written checklist, or job training and coaching. Additionally, the individual is assisted to advocate on their behalf, provided with role-playing of situations to increase their skills, and employers and coworkers are educated on how to best support the individuals. These supports not only assist the individual to maintain their employment, but also assist them to advance within their positions. Sure. Individuals with severe disabilities also have access to a full array of services, and while not funded by EE and non-vocational nature, if left unattended, could threaten the job security. These include transportation, training, access to local food shelves, interview clothing, etc. Unfortunately, sometimes people lose their job, and EE providers also provide replacement. This is cost-effective because the same provider maintains the continuity of service, and the individual again secures employment and continues to be a tax-paying citizen. The support services are designed and implemented to ensure that the participant is successful and that they're able to retain their employment. In the end, all of these services make the difference between someone retaining or losing their employment. By providing the right amount and type of supports, individuals with severe disabilities are contributing to their communities by providing meaningful work and increasing self-sufficiency. More importantly, individuals with disabilities are successfully employed and less dependent on public assistance. It just makes good business sense. Thank you again.
Thank you. What do we really want in this bill? We have about 5 minutes to wrap this bill up.
Do you want to answer his question about what you guys have both had it already? This is the
yeah. You want to comment on that? On the
Mr. Chairman, Scooby Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMA Minnesota. The bill would put the increases that were not in the base funding last year into the base
money
funding
that for this year and next year.
That's correct. And then there's also a possibility for two grant projects, pilot projects, one for students transitioning from school to work who have a serious mental illness. A lot of those kids don't graduate and end up, frankly, in the juvenile justice system. And the other is for people going through the mental health court in Hennepin County because getting a job, you know, it helps them be far more successful and stay out of the criminal justice system.
Thank you.
I am the unit sister.
What's the law committee?
I really like working, make me happy and help me to feel useful and
Mr. Chairman,
thank you.
Yeah, I think that says it all.
Mm-hmm. With that, any questions? Seeing that, Representative Wilkins renews his motion to have House File 3784 be laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Committee.
And you can meet for 5 minutes. Next, Representative Soderstrom. That's no problem. I didn't know you were gone. Representative Westerberg will move House File 3812 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. So Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman and members, House File 3812 is a bill about public safety. When ex-offenders are not helped when they leave prison, the prison system, and no one meets them at the door, they are set up to fail. We have wasted a lot of money, and often there is another victim. So I heard about Correctional Transition Services Incorporated through my jail coordinator in Pine County. Brent Jans, as I was discussing programming in the jail, mentioned that he highly respected Phil Drzelski, who is the Dakota County Jail Coordinator, and he also is the president of MAJPS, which is the Minnesota Association of Jail Programs and Services. My jail coordinator believes that program is very important, but they don't have the funds or any space to do programming. There are many prison reentry programs out there, and they all need our support. But this pilot program could be a model for us to use in our prisons and even in our jails throughout the state of Minnesota. 95% of incarcerated offenders return to our communities. Our prison population is approximately 8,500, and every year, 6,000, well, this past year in 2005, 6,857 offenders returned to our Minnesota communities, probably majority into the metro area, but many outstate Minnesota. One of the biggest problems that offenders have when they leave prison is finding a place to live. And Correctional Transition Services is requesting $350,000 for reentry housing for offenders coming out of prison. And the other problem that ex-offenders have is finding a job. Correctional Transition Services is asking for $350,000 for help in finding employment and for supporting the ex-offender in that employment. Last fall, I attended a three-day conference on reentry in Nashville, Tennessee, along with about 50 other people from Minnesota. And there were about 450 people attending this conference, and they're going to hold this conference in Minnesota next year. And I'm hoping that we have some great reentry programs and workshops that we can offer when that that conference comes to Minnesota. And many of the displays that I visited and workshops I attended talked about programs like this program you're going to hear about today. So I'm just going to go on and right with me today I have Paul Kusterman and Phil Drzelski. And they're going to tell you about their program.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, good morning. I'm Paul Kusterman, the Executive Director of Correctional Transition Services Incorporated. With me to help testify this morning is our co-founder of CTSI and the program transition manager as well, Phil Drzelski. We also have with us and available to testify and answer any questions are a couple of CTSI clients. Ms. Deanna Peterson is our resident methamphetamine expert, and Mr. Stephen Glaze, who was recently released and is in the process of transitioning back into the community. We also have a couple of CTSI staff people with us as well as also a board member. Mr. Chairman, committee members, we are grateful and excited to address you this morning and discuss our proposal for a long overdue, comprehensive, one-stop shop reentry model to serve the citizens of our state. We have for you this morning a short PowerPoint presentation. We've already provided and it's been passed around an overview of our program that contains the overview itself, a summary of the services we provided to date, as well as the a budget summary. It's a more condensed version from our other version, so it's a little more readable for you as well. So with that, we'll be also, again, happy to answer any questions you have, anything throughout the PowerPoint as well as after. Okay? You see that our objectives are very straightforward and also very ambitious. in creating a model to transition our offenders successfully and provide a continuity of care. Here you see that our model targets the major crime-producing attributes of the offender while also providing and managing the housing and employment services that lead to successful reintegration. Our services begin prior to release and in partnership with caseworkers, treatment professionals, and supervising agents, and are continued after release to ensure accountability and enhance program success.
One of the things about the
program. Want to give you a name for the record, sir?
Phil Graskowski.
Thank you.
I'm the program director of Dakota County Jail, as well as the, like Judy said, I'm the president of MAJPS. We've been working with offenders for 20 years, and one of the things that we found in working with offenders inside the institution is once they get and make some changes in the institution, they get back out in their peer groups, back out in the community, can't find housing, can't find employment, and then what are they going to revert back to? The same old thing they were in before. So we see them back in the door. So it's time that we started to address that piece in the community, and Paul and I put this together, you know, conceptually back in 98, knowing back then that we needed to do it then, and now it's prime time to do it and get it up and running.
CTSI Staffing Solutions, this is a component that we're very excited about. This allows for the client to demonstrate his or her job readiness while continuing to receive support, and for the employer to test drive our client before making a long-term commitment. The study cited here by the Department of Labor's Center for Faith-Based Initiatives involving 56 employers we found to be true with the employers we've worked with and spoken with, and also found it to be true for the property owners we've worked with as well. Speaking of housing, this is clearly the biggest need with the population we serve. Our approach here is to stabilize the client, allow them to receive services and develop skills before moving on to a more independent living situation. Among the key benefits, which are many, because the effects of crime are so far-reaching, the damage it causes to victims and communities, a comprehensive system to treat and manage the thousands of offenders released each year is the right thing to do. These startling facts point to one thing. Our corrections agencies need help. The 130,000 people on supervised release or probation equate to an average caseload in our state of 107 per agent, which is more than twice the recommended size recommended by the American Probation and Parole Association. They cannot do it themselves. Who are some of these people and where do they go when they're released? Here's a quick snapshot of the 6,800 offenders released each year. We focus here in calendar year 2004. You'll see that 65% of those as assessed as needing chemical dependency services upon admittance into the institution never received services and are being released with that risk factor still in place. As for where they go, here in St. Paul, zip code 55101 is consistent with the Dorothy Day Center. 55403 is the Salvation Army's Harbor Lights shelter downtown Minneapolis. This is not the type of housing that contributes to successful reentry and safer communities. For our clients, these are excerpts from letters we've received from clients who are soon to be released, and they tell us a number of things. One thing they tell us is that they seem to be sincere in wanting to make some permanent lifestyle changes. They also tell us that they know they need help when they're released and are taking the responsibility in getting it. To summarize, CTFI's model is unique in its design and scope, and as evidenced by a recent legislative auditor's report that found continued substance abuse treatment lacking after release, a similar gap exists in the delivery of other post-release services. Offering our state and local corrections agencies a comprehensive research and community-based model, similar to successful models in other states, is an investment in public safety and the social and economic health of families and communities throughout our state. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Soderstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to say that there are many reentry programs, and today they're talking to this committee specifically about the need for housing and for jobs. And I do believe this is a real public safety issue. It's also the cost to Minnesota, $30,000 per inmate when they fail. And they didn't bring up, but the one thing that members need to understand is that when you leave prison, you have 30 days to get a job and to find housing. And if you don't find a job in 30 days, you have violated your probation, and you very well may likely go back into the prison system. And at the terrible cost that it is today to keep them there, I just feel that we need to help them.
Just out of curiosity, is there any drug rehab or job training done in prisons today?
Yes. There's a number of programs that, like Paul addressed, there's 65% of them don't get services, but there's a percentage that do. Even within our facility, we've got an average daily population of 241, and we treat about 10 every 7 weeks. So, and there's probably about 60, 70 that need treating. So with the funding and the resources, and then with our facility, we have a high turnover in the state. There's a variety of issues and that Terry could address. Mm-hmm. He's also works in the state institution. He's on our one of our staff members.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You asked a question that I am interested in also. I think the number is it the two-thirds or three-fourths of our prisoners are chemically dependent, we know that, and it looks like about two-thirds of them don't get treated, and I think that's a real problem. I have a bill that I've been trying to figure out how to get funding both into our prisons and post-prison life for chemical dependency treatment. And Representative Sajjan, I commend you for bringing this bill forward, but unless we fund the CD part of this, these folks are going to be... Housing isn't going to help them. A job isn't going to help them. Neither one of those things are going to be sufficient. And so I'd ask you to join me. I'm trying to get a hearing out of Commissioner Bradley on the Dime a Drink bill, which would be a health impact fee to try to actually get money into our correctional system. We had testimony on this bill in the Public Safety Committee, and they actually said in prison you need the money there and you need it afterwards. So I'm going to commend you on that for bringing the bill forward, but I hope we don't leave out this part. And just one, the question is, what are you finding in terms of access to treatment for your clients? Because my understanding is they probably don't have insurance. The public funding, especially if it's a single man, doesn't cover them anymore. We took care of that a couple years ago when we said they're no longer eligible. How are they getting funding? Is it through your program? And what are you finding in terms of the gap there, just for your own program?
The Rule 25 assessments from each county in the county system do pay for Tier 1 and Tier 2. And if they make, I think it's like $8 an hour, maybe it's $7. Don't quote me on that. Then they have to pay for it themselves. So we get guys who go in debt if they agree to treatment within our facility and they don't get funded through a Rule 25, then they'll see if they can... You know, some of their family members can come up with $500 up front
and then pay the balance of it, which I think we have a Rule 43 outpatient program in our facility, which I believe it costs around $3,500. And a lot of the guys can't afford it, but so that's one of the they do fall through the cracks. The other ones that do fall through the cracks are what I call the catch-22s, where they want treatment, they don't have quite enough time to do treatment because they've been sitting going through the pretrial process, and then once they get sentenced, they don't have enough time left to complete it in there, or they don't have the money since they've been in for 3 to 6 months, and so they don't get treatment because of that. So there's a variety of those too. So out of the percentage, I think we said like 65% don't get treatment.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Black.
And what's the likelihood then, in your experience, of those folks returning right back to a life of crime and ending up in our prison system again?
Pretty high.
Do you have a number?
Extremely high. I can't. You know, if you don't treat somebody, they actually, and you put them in jail, the statistics say that they actually continue on in the system. And that's a negative 7% in all the statistics. Dr. Ed Letessa, I don't know if you heard of him, he's a criminologist out of University of Cincinnati, and they've done a variety of studies there where if you actually continue just to lock people up, what you wind up doing is educate them how to be more comfortable in an institution. So yeah, they come back and they go back to their what they're familiar with.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing this forward. I know this is a huge issue, and I've talked with the parole officers, and they are almost impossible for them to take care of it. However, my question is that I'm curious about is I toured the Wasika prison, which is federal, and if I'm not mistaken, everyone that comes in, which is minimum security, I believe, so they're at the end, but they are not allowed to leave. If they have come with a chemical dependency problem of some sort, they are not allowed to leave until they have completed the program, which it's 6 to 9 months. It's quite an extensive program. Do we not do that on the state level in our prisons?
Representative
Soto? No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Ruth. No, we really don't do that. I have another bill that people who are in the jail should get some education on the dangers of meth. And in testimony, these people did not even get meth education in the prison system because they weren't there long enough. I don't think you go into their treatment center within the prison unless you're there like 3 years. So there's so many people that are cycling in and out. And I don't have those figures, but one of the largest population in our prison system are the probation violators. Now, they violated because they didn't find a job or they didn't find housing or they had a bad UA or a few other things. So there are reasons they get back, and they have not committed another crime, but they are back in our prison system. And I'd like to mention a few things that have not been brought up. Phil believes in cognitive behavior education, and if you can understand that people that become addicts when they're very young, like maybe 12 years old or 13 years old, they have the mentality of a 12 or 13 year old. They have never matured. And so there is a great need within our prison system, within our jails, and also when they come out, is to help them through. And that's a counseling process. And Phil has done a lot of research and does use that within his own jail program. And then another thing, and CCSI does that also. Another thing is that they charge for the beds in jail. When you leave, besides trying to find a job and place to live, you've got a bill. We had a bill because we charge now for those beds. And another thing is that I just recently have met a fellow because I do a faith-based jail ministry, and he just called me last week, I believe, and he's been in jail for 3 months, and now he's gotten behind on his child support. And so now, because I talked to his child support person, he's been kept up for years, but then got picked up and was in jail for 3 months. Now they're going to take his driver's license. So, you know, we kind of have a system that doesn't help people succeed when they get out, because besides he's got a bill to pay for his time he sat in jail, he might lose his driver's license, he's 3 months behind in his child support, and he doesn't have a job, and he can't read. That's one of the situations I was so interested in trying to help. This man is 40 years old, does not read. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have another person who wants to say something. We have three bills to do in 25 minutes, so we have to kind of move it on.
Mr. Chairperson, committee members.
If we don't get these passed today, they won't have a chance.
Well, we're trying to move along and work with you. Mr. Terrence Peach is our chemical dependency manager. So we were on the subject of chemical dependencies. We brought him up to answer more specific questions as well.
Appreciate
and we also have a client who can give you some firsthand information about her trials and tribulations as well.
If we have to go through that, we'll delay this bill for later. So let's move on.
My name is Terrence Peach. Presently, I work for the Department of Corrections. I've been in the department since 1993. I'm a therapist. I work in the chemical dependency program in Llano Lakes. I'm about ready to retire, and I'm going to work over here. One of the things in Llano, the triad program, there's not enough staff to treat all of the inmates in the program, and the program is 260 inmates in triad. There's not enough time. There's not enough staff. And there's too many inmates who need help. A lot of guys coming out do not receive treatment because we're maxed out. The DOC is maxed out within treatment. So people are leaving without treatment. We also have the CRP program, which is a correctional release program in the Department of Corrections. And people are being released early. One of the big things they have to do is set up transition out. They have to set up a release plan. They have to set up housing. They got to get jobs before they can be released. This is a vital component of it, or will be.
Thank you very much. I know there's a big urgency in all of this. I have a nephew that's in prison in St. Cloud for meth, so I have a personal experience. But anyway, seeing no other questions, Representative Westenberg will renew his motion to have House File 3812 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much. Wish we had more time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Clemson.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move House File 3151 for possible inclusion.
Very well.
Sign in for the record.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
We have three bills to pass in 20 minutes, so please make it as short as possible.
I'm going to be brief, but yes. I really think that...
You want to move this bill? She's already been moved, but that's right.
I moved it already, President Clark. You can, yeah.
Double move it. Okay, very well. I'll triple move it.
I appreciate the support, members of the committee. And I do want to be very brief, but I really think that we've found a program here that embodies jobs and economic opportunity. It really holds up strong work ethic in their program. And with that, I turn it over to the testifiers who represent Summit Academy and are asking for this appropriation for their new program for 100 hard hats.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Welcome to our committee.
Good evening. So much. I'm Lewis King, President and CEO of Summit Academy OIC. I think some of you are familiar with the OIC network here in the state of Minnesota. We've been before you. I'm here to discuss and ask for your support for the 100 Hard Hats program. Very simply put, several years ago we made a decision to focus on the construction sector and partner with Dunwoody College of Technology and make sure that we had trained plumbers, painters, carpenters, and now residential electrical workers. Early on, we had some difficulties with the program, but now we've achieved a 58% completion rate and an average placement rate that approaches $12.50 an hour. The people who come through this program are primarily African American men from North Minneapolis. 60% of them are fathers. 80% of them were unemployed in the previous period. But before I go on, I would like to turn it over to Mr. Victor Seals, who has been the beneficiary of our 20-week training program and is now a plumber.
Welcome to our committee. Give your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Victor Seals, Mr. Chairman, committee members, Representative Clinton.
I'd like to thank you once again for this opportunity to be able to come before you. This is the first time before this committee, but my second time here at the Capitol building, so I definitely appreciate the opportunity. As Mr. King said, I am a beneficiary of Summit Academy. I graduated from Summit Academy just a little over 2 years ago from the pre-apprentice carpentry and plumbing program, and I've been working full-time as a union plumber ever since. Just to give you some background of what brought me to the doors of Summit Academy, I am also a recent transplantee to the state of Minnesota from Michigan. I came directly from Michigan after having served 15 years in the Michigan Department of Corrections for an armed robbery I committed when I was 18 years old. I was incarcerated my entire adult life. I had no marketable skills when I came here. I had no formal training, and only had a GED as far as education went. I had no clue what I was going to do when I came here. All I knew is that Michigan was not where I wanted to be. So, that being said, eventually through working part-time jobs, I was introduced to Summit Academy, and the program intrigued me because of the duration of the program. It was a short program, and you know, it promised a whole lot. And I went into it with shaded lenses, not really knowing what to expect, but it delivered on its promise. I went through the 10 weeks of pre-apprentice carpentry, moved on to the 10 weeks at Dunwoody, was more than pleased with what I was offered at Dunwoody through the pre-apprentice plumbing program, and they absolutely prepared me to go before the Joint Apprenticeship Training Committee in Minneapolis, and the rest is history. I've been working as a union plumber ever since. I've been able to get married. I have two wonderful stepchildren, and I mean, life has definitely been a huge improvement over the previous 15 years.
Thank you very much. Any questions from members? Seeing none.
Wait, I got a question.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, do you ever wish you were a pipe fitter?
It's an inside joke between you. Leave it at that. You don't have to answer.
Okay. Representative Gravelow and Representative Bohan this. Now we'll lay this open for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you very much, and good to see you again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, committee.
Representative Fritz.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I'd like to move House File 3633 for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Very well. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning. Thank you, members, for hearing my bill this morning. I appreciate that, and I appreciate the time that we have left here, so I'll be somewhat brief. However, I have House File 3633, which is a bill asking for the legislature to give us some money for the Paradise Arts Center in Faribault, Minnesota. The Paradise Arts Center is an old movie theater right down in the middle of town. And I have with me today the president of the board of the Paradise Arts Center, Matt Dredlow. We have a few storyboards that I will put up, and I'll let Matt explain the project. We have a very, it's a pinnacle area for us in our in the town of Faribault. We're excited about it. We've raised a lot of money and done an awful lot of work, but we do need money for the handicap access and elevator. So I'll turn it over to Matt Dredlow.
Welcome to the committee. Keep your name for us.
Thank you. My name is Matt Dredlow. I'm the president of the Paradise Center for the Arts. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and the committee for hearing us this morning. I'm going to try and keep this really brief because I know you're pressed for time. The Paradise Center for the Arts is a project that was started about 2 years ago, with the idea of there was three local groups, arts groups in the community, two theater groups and one visual arts group that were looking for a new facility to move into so they all would have a shared home. We identified the Paradise Theater, which is the old theater in downtown Faribault, as a possible area to move into. The Paradise Theater kind of has a rich history in Faribault. It's actually built directly upon the foundation of the old Grand Opera House that was in Faribault that was known as one of the best opera houses in the Midwest in its time, but it burned to the ground. In response to that, the Paradise Theater was built directly atop the old foundation of the Grand. It was built completely out of concrete and brick. There isn't a stick of wood in it, so it was a very nice sound structure to work with, so we decided that's what we were going to start with. The pictures that you see right now are actual. We were able to find the original architectural drawings for the Paradise Theater in the archives of the University of Minnesota, as well as some photos of the theater directly after it's completed. The Paradise is an atmospheric theater, which there is only about, I think, four left in the states at most, and maybe 20 in the country, when there used to be well over 500. An atmospheric theater is the kind of defining characteristic. As you can see in the auditorium, they had castles built along the wall, and the stage was meant to look kind of, it was meant to look like you were sitting in the courtyard of an old castle watching a royal theatrical performance. And the ceiling was rounded and painted dark purple, and holes were cut in the ceilings, and light was shining through from the top to make it look like there were stars twinkling in the ceiling. Then there was a machine called the Brendelgraf magic lantern that was used in the back that projected clouds up on the ceiling that slowly moved across the ceiling during the performance, so that once the lights had brought down, it appeared the ceiling disappeared and that you were in this castle courtyard. They are very historically significant theaters in the theatrical world. Like I said, there is four, I think, left that are in some form operational in Minnesota. One of them is actually in Rochester. It is the Barnes & Noble. Now they're using the interiors of Barnes & Noble. I think there's one here in the city, is one called the Suburban World, and I don't know if that's being operated as a theater anymore or not. And then in Austin they have one as well, but I believe those are the only ones that left. When we started looking at the facility, we thought it was a great facility that needed to be saved. Most of the architectural features in the interior are still in place and going to be preserved, with the exception of the theater. It used to seat 950 people, and I don't know how many of you are familiar with downtown Faribault, but trying to park 950 people in downtown Faribault was not going to be an option. So we shortened it up to a 350-seat theater, which we think would be more advantageous for us, and then as part of that, we used the vacated space in the back of the theater to add in some classroom space for the extensive programming that the Art Center offers in pottery, painting, and the like. And that classroom space will be located both on the second floor and on the first floor, as well as a regional gallery will be set in the space on the first floor, so we'll have a gallery display area. We've been able to raise a significant amount of money for the project from the local community. We've got about $1 million raised from the local community already, including $250,000 that's been contributed by the city of Faribault itself. And the city of Faribault is looking at this as being kind of a key to revitalizing our downtown and maintaining our traditional downtown as we get more and more inundated by the kind of the urban sprawl that's spreading our way. We are well into the project. In fact, through the help of the state prison system, we've been able to do a lot of the work with discounted labor from the prison facility. They've come in, and actually the cement floor in the basement needs to be removed and lowered down 8 inches, and the prisoners have come in over the last 3 weeks and hauled out 32 roll-off dumpsters worth of rubble out of the basement and moved quite a few cubic yards of gravel out of the basement so we could drop the entire floor down 8 inches and make the lower area accessible and usable space. Because of Faribault's kind of special location with both residential academies, with both the State School for the Blind and the State School for the Deaf, that we do have an increased number of handicapped individuals living in the community. So rather than just taking what I would call cursory steps to make the building handicap accessible and meet with the compliance requirements that we had to do, we kind of went above and beyond that and made sure that the main floor restrooms were completely handicap accessible rather than just providing one unisex handicap accessible bathroom in one area of the building. Also putting in a full elevator so that the handicapped individuals in our community would have access to all the classrooms, not just the one classroom that's been added on the main level. And those things, like I said, when you're dealing with a structure that's built completely out of reinforced concrete, become a little bit expensive when you have to start cutting holes in the floor and putting in a cinder block area for the elevator to go on. Also, we've added in a full lift by the stage so that you can have access to the stage itself and also to the dressing rooms below the stage for handicapped individuals, so they should have full access to the theater component of it as well. We have also applied for a number of private grants to get the remaining money for the project. We started with an initial opening date, trying to get the facility open and operational by
We are hoping by the winter of 2007, right now, because of the overwhelming response we've got from the community in Faribault and some of the other things that have fallen in place, and the incredible help we've gotten from the prisoners out of the state prison system who are doing a lot of the work and saving us a lot of money. We are targeting a opening date of winter 2007 instead, so we are now about a year ahead of schedule. But we could really use some help with this handicapped accessibility portion of the bill. We're not asking for a grand amount of money in the grand scheme of things here, but it would make a very huge difference to our ability to complete this project on time and also make it a facility that would be kind of the linchpin of a kind of revitalization of downtown Faribault and maintaining it as kind of a vital part of our community rather than having it slowly disappear, which is what has happened in a lot of communities as the big box stores and some of the restaurants start moving in on the periphery of the town.
Well, yeah, Representative Slaughter.
Mr. Chair and Representative Fritz, an interesting project. And I have a question, though. Don't they, for handicap accessibility, aren't there federal grants or some kind of grant program specifically to when places are trying to put in handicap facilities?
Not to my knowledge. I've done a lot of looking into it to try and find some money through the federal programs. There are some federal monies there, possibly to... We look at some federal monies to preserve the historic aspects of the theater, but the problem with those is they're an all-or-nothing thing. You have to put it exactly back the way it was if you want those federal monies, and that just didn't make sense for us in this facility to put back a 950-seat theater with a limited lobby area rather than putting in a multidisciplinary facility like we're putting in. So we have not been able to find any appreciable federal monies for the handicap accessibility or for the historic preservation aspect of the project.
Just out of curiosity, if you don't put it in, what happens?
If we don't put the handicap accessibility in?
That's correct.
We could curb back the project and, like I said, put in one unisex handicap accessible bathroom on the main floor, and we do provide for one classroom on the main floor, and I do believe that that would meet the requirements of what we have to do, and we would scale back the upstairs to bring the occupancy back just a few people so we wouldn't need the elevator anymore. But what it would do is right now on the second floor we have the Faribault Arts Center is known pretty well throughout that area for having a tremendous pottery program, and we do some really interesting pottery projects there and programs, and it would be very difficult to give full access to those programs to anyone with handicaps because all that equipment would be located on the second floor. We could bring a wheel down, but they would not be able to participate with the rest of the class in doing that. So it would have an effect on it, but we could scale it back and take some of those things out, but I would prefer not to.
Fairmont has an opera house also, and Fairmont and Faribault get mixed up quite often. But anyway, we have the same problem. We have to build an elevator that goes to four floors because you get mezzanines and stuff. But anyway, it's a problem. Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It just sounds like a great project, but it's not a whole lot of money. Money is short. So what about, have you got commitment from the city? Are there matching funds or anything that you could use?
The city has also already committed $250,000 to the project. And on top of that, we've raised a significant portion of $750,000 from the local community and just private donations, a lot of them $50 to $100 at a time. So we've done a lot of legwork in getting that done, and we are applying for grants through the McKnight Foundation and other foundations within the state to try and get the remainder of the money put together. But the total project is about a $2 million project, and Faribault being about 20,000 people, trying to raise the full $2 million from the local community is going to be, would be very difficult. It would probably drag the project out about 5 or 6 years.
There were any other questions? Seeing none.
Okay.
Representative Sertich renews his motion to have House File 3633 laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I appreciate it.
Representative Yaros, welcome to our committee and formally your committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm nostalgic.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney,
I'd like to move House File 3568. And does it have to go to taxes?
I believe so.
To taxes?
Okay, Mr. Chairman, House File 3568, as you said, I think earlier,
would pay working people less than what we politicians make on a supposedly part-time job.
Just barely.
Yeah. It defines a living wage as 14 hours per hour or 11 hours with health care benefits. Employers are not expected but not required to pay a living wage. New businesses with 10 employees or less are exempt from the surtax. During the first 3 years after the adoption of the bill, only employers with more than 20 full-time workers will be required to pay a living wage. The revenue from the surtax is returned to low-income workers through the working family tax credit. We don't have much time. We have two people here to testify, Ms. Thomas and Bernie Haas.
Ms. Thomas, talks first.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Carrie Thomas with the Jobs Now Coalition. Just quickly, the wage requirements in this bill, actually, as members of the committee know from previous presentations on the cost of living in Minnesota research, the wage requirements in this bill, $14 an hour in the metro or $11 with health insurance, I think it's $12 an hour in non-metro, $9 an hour with health insurance. That'll reflect actually the cost of living that families need in the state. And I'll give you a couple of examples. In the average annual cost of meeting basic needs for a family of four with two workers in the metro region is actually over $54,000 a year. So each worker in that family of four would have to earn at least $13 an hour just to meet their most basic family needs. So no retirement savings, no debt repayment, no emergency needs, no big ticket items. 38% of jobs in the metro area right now actually pay less than $13 an hour. I'd also remind members that it's
just speak again, please. 38%.
38% of jobs in the metro area pay less than $13.05 per hour. The other thing I would point out is that if the current minimum wage of $6.15 per hour had kept pace with inflation since its high point in 1968, it would now be $8.98 an hour, very close to the $9 an hour requirement in this bill, which would be the lowest requirement in this bill. In Greater Minnesota in 2004, about one of every four jobs, 25%, paid less than the inflation-adjusted minimum wage of $8.98 an hour. And actually in the metro area, 15% of jobs paid less than that. So I think that what this bill is trying to accomplish, which is setting a higher standard and actually reflects what workers need to meet their most basic needs of their families without having to rely on any public subsidies. So I'll leave it at that, and I'd answer any questions, but I'll turn it over to Bernie.
Welcome to the
committee.
Give me your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bernie House. I'm with the Food and Commercial Workers, Local 789. I'll do this in under a minute. We stand in support of House Bill 3568. We represent retail workers in the East Metro who average about $13 an hour plus health and welfare. Their counterparts work in other chains such as Walmart. In wage surveys that we've done, you get about $7.25 and $7.15 an hour full time to start. I've yet to interview a Walmart worker who was enrolled in the company's health care plan in the last 6 weeks. Retail is the fastest growing sector for jobs in the East Metro. People deserve a living wage. We estimate savings alone, if wages were lifted up with this bill, would save the state of Minnesota $14 to $15 million a year alone just with Walmart because of health care being taken care of by the company instead of taxpayers' backs. This bill would also wean some companies from state-funded dependence. This is more of an accountability bill than a feel-good bill. Just for example, recently West St. Paul, the city, gave Target over $700,000 in TIF for 19 full-time jobs that started at $7.50 an hour, and after 2 years they're supposed to be up to $10 an hour. You can't live on $7.50, you can't live on $10 an hour and provide for your family. Retail won't collapse if wages are risen, and we would ask you to support this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Thomas, I have a question. What is the highest minimum wage in the United States today?
Mr. Chair, members, I believe the highest minimum wage is Washington State, and I think it's $7.36 per hour. It might be a couple cents more than that or a couple cents less.
Okay, thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, I'd also add that I think there are now 19 states that have a minimum wage higher than the federal minimum.
Including Minnesota?
Including Minnesota.
How many have more than Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, it's more than half of those have more than Minnesota, but I could get the committee the full list.
That would be neat. Representative Clark.
Quick question. Can you give us the website again for the calculator? I think it would be important for this committee to be reminded that there is a way for us to understand what these numbers actually mean, because Ms. Thompson's organization has gone through and figured out what it costs in each of our communities to just survive, and so I wonder if you could give us that website again.
Mr. Chair, members, it's www.jobsnowcoalition.org/cost of living, and that takes you directly to the calculator. You can pick your county, pick your family configuration, calculate wages, and you can actually customize it. So if your housing costs less or your health care costs more, you can find out your own wage.
Okay. We're 3 minutes past. Any more questions? Seeing none, Representative Mahoney renews his...
Strongly renew my motion.
Strongly renew his motion. Have House File 3568 be passed and moved to taxes. All in favor of that, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion fails.
Division.
Thank you very much.
Division, Mr. Chair.
Division has been asked. All in favor of the Representative Mahoney's motion, raise their right hand. Notice I made it right, didn't you?
I think that should be left hand.
Fine. all opposed, raise your left hand. Chairman's hearing is very active.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Fitter.
I was wondering if we can reconsider that and potentially have a motion to pass this on to Tax Committee without recommendation.
Representative Fitter, do you want to make that a motion?
I think that needs to be two motions, but I'd like to make both the first one first.
What's the first one?
Motion to reconsider.
Motion to reconsider. All in favor of the motion. Representative Sturdish's motion to reconsider, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion fails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members.
Thank you, Representative Yarrow. And we got anything else? Okay, you all have the schedule of events that's going to happen between now and getting our bill out. Thank you very much. We're adjourned.